212-340-1975. That's 212-340-1975. Or follow us on Facebook at Proud Africans Empowerment. Be there.
And once again, this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. This is a listener-sponsored community radio station providing you a Pacifica state of mind since 1960. And we are in day number 3 of our winter fun drive here for 2018, making sure funds are raised so we can continue to provide you information that you expect from us here on a regular basis. The number to call to show your support financially is 516-620-3602. Once again, 516-620-3602, or go to give to WBAI.org on the web. That's give to WBAI.org on the web. Or you can text to donate by texting WBAI to the number 41444. Once again, text to donate, texting WBAI to the number 41444 on your smartphone. You do that, and in return, you will receive a link, and the link will open up into a page on your smartphone, and it will ask you how much you want to donate to WBAI. You can start it off as little as $5, but you can, don't stop there, you can definitely expand the donations, whatever you feel comfortable in donating. $25, $50, $100, $500, $1,000, you get the idea. Stay tuned for the WBAI Evening News with Linda Perry coming up in this hour, followed by the Wednesday edition of Trump Watch here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Stay tuned.
Good evening. For WBAI News in New York, I'm Linda Perry.
And feeling like you're sleeping outside and crying yourself to sleep because it's so unbelievably and painfully cold in your room.
So far this winter, 323,098 NYCHA residents have had no heat and or hot water this winter. That's 143,000 of NYCHA's public housing units out of 175,000. The New York City Council's Oversight and Investigations Committee held a hearing this week on the causes of the crisis. That's where NYCHA Chair Shola Olatwaye and her staff were grilled. Corey Johnson is the newly elected chair of the New York City Council.
And I have to say that I am astonished. We knew that this was bad, but when you actually look at the full numbers that we received, it is something else. So I have some pretty straightforward questions for this hearing. How on earth could this happen? How did we get here? First, we find out there are issues related to lead. Then we find out that residents are not being provided heat or hot water. What is next? But we can't just sit here and wait for another shoe to drop. We have to get a handle on this.
I have been troubled by the housing authority's lack of transparency.
Bronx Councilmember Richie Torres is chair of the New York City Council's Housing Committee.
The chairperson, as well as your spokesperson, have publicly said that 97% of NYCHA apartments have had consistent heat and hot water, giving the impression that there's no crisis. That's what those numbers tell me. And then when I find out that 323,000 residents at one point had no heat and hot water, what are the number of units in your portfolio?
175,000.
And out of 175,000, how many of them, of those units, did not have heat and hot water at one point?
143,000.
143,000 out of 175,000. And so my question to you is, in the interest of full transparency, why did NYCHA not share those numbers with the general public? Why do we have to wait for a, because I had no idea that 323,000 residents in public housing had no heat and hot water. I had no idea that nearly every unit in public housing at one point had a heating and hot water outage. Why do we have to wait for a city council hearing for NYCHA to be forthcoming with the public about the true nature of its heating crisis?
So first, I'll say, you know, we are still in the middle of heating season one, and one of the important developments is our establishment of a compliance department to really understand and analyze our data for a level of precision and accuracy. I think it's also important to note in terms of while, and I think I will say this again, the interruption of service for any of our residents, but certainly of that scale, is unacceptable. And there were certainly some outliers. I visited some of those outliers myself, Patterson being one of them, where residents did suffer with the council member, Ayala, we were together, did suffer from a prolonged outages. And that was incredibly regrettable, and we are working to, with these recent resources, to quickly replace the mobile boilers there so that we can guarantee a level of service. But I think it's really important that we are, to state that, one, we really want to be precise with our numbers. We really want to understand the length of time. We want to understand the impact of the potential outages, and that's what we're working to do. And these resources that the mayor and hopefully eventually the council will support will help us do that, so that our 400,000 residents do not have to suffer through another spell like this. So agreeing and conceding the point that our data was evolving, and we are working to ensure that it is more precise and that we can deliver a better level of service to our residents.
Mayor, at what point did it come to your attention that nearly every unit in your portfolio at one point had no heat and hot water, and that 323,000 residents at one point had no heat and hot water? At what point did those sobering statistics come to your attention?
I monitor the daily outage report, and we can see on a regular basis the numbers of units that are affected. So this is an ongoing and regular level of communication. Again, I think we need to get more precise in our data, but absolutely understand the depth of and the number of families affected by this heating crisis.
New York City Councilmember Mark Traeger is visibly upset with inaction in his district. He represents the neighborhoods of Bensonhurst, Coney Island, and Seagate, where 5 years after Sandy, recovery dollars haven't yet fixed problems at NYCHA Housing.
Chair Alatayeh, do you recall a historic February 2014 council hearing at Carey Gardens in Coney Island, co-chaired by my colleague Richie Torres and myself?
I do know that that happened. I don't believe I was actually on the job yet.
Great. Do you recall the impetus for that hearing?
I believe it was the pace of the Sandy recovery was ultimately the issue.
The impetus for the hearing were boilers. Do you recall a March 2015 press conference that you attended with Mayor de Blasio and Red Hook announcing a $3 billion FEMA grant to repair Sandy damaged developments?
I don't recall the specific press conference, but I do know that that is a resource commitment from FEMA.
Today is February 6th, 2018. Do all of my Sandy damaged NYCHA developments have permanent boilers functioning today?
No, they do not.
That's all I needed to hear.
If I may, they do.
You testified that funding shortages are the main source of chronic heating problems. Is that correct?
I believe we've talked about a number of things. Funding.
But is funding shortages the main source of chronic heating problems?
It is absolutely one of the primary reasons.
Okay. So it's been over 5 years since Sandy, with close to $3 billion, and we still have developments with temporary boilers where residents do not have regulated heat, either too hot or too cold. So why should we have confidence in NYCHA to resolve heating problems with adequate funding when the record says otherwise?
Mm-hmm. So let's just be also clear that the agreement with FEMA for the money was 2015. So it's not been 3 years yet that we have been working with the $3 billion. To your point, we are going into all construction this year. We are making progress on our heaters. I do want to point out that there have been some problems early on with our temporary boilers. They performed without going down during the season to date. The Redfern went down. It was not the temporary boiler. We fixed the problem outside of the that plant.
Respectfully, the stories that I heard by the residents today were the same stories that I witnessed with my own two eyes years ago when I went door-to-door in Cary Gardens and O'Dwyer Gardens and Surfside in my district, where I saw residents with their children wrapped in blankets sitting by an open oven, which is a carbon monoxide danger. And I testified at that hearing in Cary Gardens that I never want to see that again. And today, we continue to deal with the same problems with billions of dollars. So it's not just a money issue, it is a management of money issues, or a mismanagement of money issues. Now, as you have noted, these are violations in laws and rules. Has there been a discussion about a rent rollback for the residents who have been subjected to the loss of heat?
So we have not and do not plan to change. Well, do you want to hear?
They have not been getting the services which they are legally required to receive. NYCHA, at minimum, owes them a rent rollback or rent reduction for the services that they have not been given.
No hand clapping, please.
And secondly, we've heard from the speaker in both chairs about the need, and I think you have agreed that there is a need to hire additional folks to deal with the heating problems. At minimum, I think that there should be a waiver of the DCAS exam fee for NYCHA residents, because you have people with the skills and the qualifications and the interest to work in the very developments which they live in. And I'll ask the last question. You've noted that the Deputy Mayor, Alicia Glenn, oversees the NYCHA portfolio. During the recent bomb cyclone deep freeze period, did she accompany you to any of the impacted developments during that deep freeze period?
No, she did not.
So let me just say this. We are dealing with a crisis in NYCHA, a crisis in confidence. And if we are to be honest about their problems, we all need to be honest about that problem. And we are committed in this council to make sure that NYCHA gets the funding that it deserves. But we need confidence that you will use the money the right way to help the residents that we all serve. And I thank the chairs for their time.
Queens Council Member Jimmy Van Bramer also questions Alatwaye about the chain of command.
Because you are here getting grilled, and I have to say I've been at over 1,000 hearings in my ninth year as a city council member now. This is one of the worst that I've ever seen in terms of performance. You're here, but you report to somebody, right? Your direct report is it the first deputy mayor or?
Deputy Mayor Alicia Glenn.
Right. And I understand that she's a very smart person, and she knows a lot of things about a lot of things. So what I'd like to know is, how often do you meet with her? How often are your direct reports to Alicia Glenn?
Weekly.
And is she responsive to the needs of public housing residents?
We work very closely together, and the investment that we have to date is reflective of that support.
Is that investment enough, and is it good enough for the residents of public housing?
Councilmember Van Bramer, you will not get an agreement that we don't have so much more to do. I will not say that. And I don't think she would say that either. But what?
Well, then, because she's so smart, she should probably do better at funding and doing things for residents of public housing. I just want to say this to you, Chair. We've done some good work together in Queensbridge, Ravenswood, the Woodside Houses. And you're getting grilled here. And appropriately so, because a lot has gone wrong. But you, by protecting the deputy mayor, don't do any service to yourself or to the residents of public housing. I want to go beyond, because Alicia Glenn reports to somebody too, and that's the mayor of the city of New York, right?
Correct.
You're listening to the news on WBAI New York. The New York City Council hearing into the lack of heat and hot water in NYCHA housing. Rosie Fernandez of Manhattan's Carver Houses is with Community Voices Heard.
And now imagine having to use your oven to make your apartment warm, even though you know it's dangerous, but your only other options are to freeze or wear your coat and gloves inside. Imagine trying to make a hot tea so at least you'd have something warm going into your freezing body, only to find you have no water. And without water, you can't even cook a hot meal. But maybe if you have money, you can order some hot food or eat nothing. Imagine nights where you can't even take a hot shower because now you have no hot water. And imagine having the flu this past Christmas and feeling like you're sleeping outside and crying yourself to sleep because it's so unbelievably and painfully cold in your room. You may not be able to imagine that, but that's my life. Should anyone have to live like this? And it's not just the heat water issues. I've been to the ER countless times because of black mold. Is this acceptable to you?
Fernandez says there's a desperate need for funds to fix NYCHA and a surplus of incompetence.
You gotta give me a minute, because this is hard.
Tenant organizer Carmen Quinones is president of Douglas Housing, also in Manhattan. She's a member of Community Voices Heard.
I went to Puerto Rico because my dad was dying, only to get stuck in Hurricane Maria. I almost died. To come back home to the health crisis in NYCHA. And as Rose said, this deficit of funds and the surplus of incompetence, that is why we are not only calling for the money that is needed to fix heating systems, $2 billion this year, but also the creation of a resident-led oversight council. NYCHA management has shown itself incapable of protecting our well-being. It has a track record of failure. We, the residents, must play a bigger role in the management through the creation of a resident-led oversight council. Those who are closest to the problem are closest to the solution. NYCHA chair and management should not only have to report to you, the city council, but they should be mandated to report to us, the residents, at least quarterly through the oversight council. This would be a council led by residents that would include leaders from faith, labor, and community groups with an investment in public housing. Additionally, NYCHA's long track record of closing tickets before repairs get done is inexcusable.
Quinones wants the system changed so that it's the tenants who can sign off when repairs are completed. Brooklyn Councilmember Carlos Menchaca takes up the tenants' proposals with the NYCHA panel.
I want to get a clearer answer now about developing this resident-led oversight council. That idea is strong, and I've heard it over and over again, that can help amplify the work at the city council level that is really led by members of the community. And so I'm kind of wondering if you can appoint a person that we can follow up with on this idea and take that further.
Sure.
Yeah? Is there a person that you can give us right now that we can follow up with?
The person who...
That can help us take this idea next.
Well, one, interested in the idea and like to learn more, Sadia Sherman, who's our EVP for community and community engagement and programs, would be the person and point person to discuss further.
Wonderful. So we'll follow up with them on that. There's a real power to the participatory process that I think residents that understand their everyday life can really bring to the system. We've heard from them about wanting to have the power to close the tickets. We want to bring that into light. And that has been something that has been done in the past, I believe. You can actually correct me if I'm wrong, if that's never been done before, and whether or not this would be a new idea on allowing residents to close their own tickets if they see that the problem has been solved. Is that a new idea, or has that been something that NYCHA has done in the past?
I think,
in today's technology, that would be a new idea, but it's certainly something we can take a look at. We are able to ask tenants to sign when, you know, we've completed a repair at a unit. So that is built in, but I think you're talking about when something is incomplete or particularly related to heat. So, yes, I think we need to improve some ways to do that, and there have been several suggestions, I think, that are worthy of us exploring.
There have been calls for Olatwaye to step down after she misinformed the New York City Council about lead inspections in NYCHA units. Under oath, she stated that 4,226 inspections had been done when only a handful of inspections were actually completed. Chair Johnson wants an apology from Olatwaye. He sort of got some admission from her, but not really a full apology. Councilmember Ruben Diaz Sr. from the Bronx is watching the proceedings. He's wearing his signature cowboy hat.
We've been asking for your resignation. We have been asking for your resignation. But today, sitting in here, I noticed that all those surrounding you are the ones that know, are the ones that answering the questions. And you are sitting there patiently listening to them. And I say, a clean house has to be done. Otherwise, the discrimination, and I'm listen to the words that I'm using, the discrimination and racism done to our people will continue. Thank you very much.
I'm actually going to interject.
Councilmember Torres.
Because I do have to ask questions about the lead site. You indicated earlier in response to questions from Councilman Diaz that you make every effort to correct the record. As you know, there was a DOI finding, that testimony that you submitted to the council on December 7th was factually false. Have you responded to that letter in writing? Have you sent a letter to the city council correcting the record?
I appreciate the question, and I've always endeavored to tell the truth to this body, and will continue to do so. I know that a letter was sent to the speaker and to this body specific to this issue. We have a copy of the letter. I believe we can share that with you again. I know that my team met with you and the speaker and the other chair around this issue to provide context. So we believe, and if there are more questions as it relates to my December 6th testimony, I'd be happy to receive them and give you those answers. But today,
do you acknowledge that your testimony was false at the time you gave it?
As I said, I absolutely hear the question, and I believe that I was endeavoring to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
And so
I'm not concerned with
so today.
Your belief. What concerns me is whether your testimony that those 4,200 units were inspected by HUD certified professionals, was that factually accurate?
So as I said to you, I mean, I know that you have a letter and we sat down and talked to you.
I know, but we're in a
issue.
Public forum, so
understood.
It has to be stated for
I
the
understand.
Record.
And I believe that that letter actually went into detail, and as well as our meeting, to provide you context.
Was it factually false, yes or no?
I absolutely hear the question, and if okay. there are
I know more, you hear my question. I want you to answer my question.
Yes. So like I said, I believe we've provided you information to your question.
So there are three possible explanations. Either you knew and lied, or you came to know and then withheld the truth, or you did not know what you should have known. You have said, your staff has indicated that you did not know, that you were misinformed. So my question is, who misinformed you?
So thank you for your question.
Yeah.
And as I've said, I'm not going to get into names and individual personnel decisions in an open forum. One of the important things.
I'll ask a different question then.
Okay.
The person who misinformed you, has that person been held accountable?
We have, as part of our compliance effort, we are working to ensure that.
Has that person been held accountable?
Every data point.
Has that person been held accountable, yes or no?
That person and others is accurate to the best of our knowledge.
Has that person been held accountable?
As I've said, I'm not going to get into individual personnel discussions.
I'm not asking you to reveal the identity of the individual. I'm asking whether the person who misinformed you, and again, it is unreasonable to expect an agency head to know every minute detail in an agency as complex as NYCHA.
Thank you.
Having said that, you should have known the basic facts of a lead safety program that has been the subject of a federal investigation for 2 years. You had weeks to prepare in advance of the committee hearing. I was asking a question about those 4,200 units with the most vulnerable children. That is a question to which you should have known the answer.
Let me just interject here. So, Madam Chair, I understand that you feel constrained for whatever reason in answering the chair's questions.
Council Speaker Corey Johnson.
If folks would remain quiet. It is not unreasonable, given that he's not asking you to reveal a name, to acknowledge that because we've taken at face value what you've said to us and what your spokesperson has said publicly to the media, that you were briefed incorrectly and not given proper information by staff ahead of that hearing. You've provided context that it was a 6.5-hour hearing, that you sat and testified and answered every question to the best of your ability, and that you spent a significant amount of time preparing for that hearing and understanding all the issues that were going to be raised. And one question, which was an important question, you gave an answer which now we know is inaccurate, and I, as speaker, have taken at face value that you were not sufficiently or properly briefed by staff. It is not inappropriate for the chairs of these committees to ask, we're not asking who, has the person who did not brief you properly, have they been held accountable in some way? I think that's a reasonable question. I even think it would be reasonable to know who that was, but we're not asking that right now. Has that person been held accountable?
So, one, again,
we're not even asking what accountability means. We're asking, has that person been held accountable?
Have we had conversations about, are we having conversations about the integrity of our data? Absolutely.
No.
How that information gets to the executive level? Absolutely. How that information gets to me? Absolutely. And that is a message that is being, delivered.
Madam Chair, you're not answering
the
questions.
Throughout the organization. I'm trying to be.
Has the Corporation Council told you that you can't answer these questions?
I'll say it.
Corporation Counsel Zach Carter didn't say Olatoye couldn't answer Johnson's questions, but it's highly unusual for him to be in attendance at this kind of city council investigatory hearing. Carter says there was a lack of clarity, and as a result, mistakes were made.
There's no single person involved in the preparation of the chairman who was responsible for that mistake.
Counselor, this is
if you permit me to finish, please.
Okay. Your answer is a departure from everything that's been told of us in the last 2 weeks. What has been told of us on one-on-one meetings, private meetings, individual meetings, conversations with the mayor's office and with NYCHA, was that she was not prepared properly. So if you are now saying that has changed, that there was a mistake and there was confusion on the answer to the question, that is a departure from what has been told of us
last
2 weeks.
That is not a departure in the least. The two things are not mutually exclusive. There was a lack of clarity in the information provided to the chair.
Okay.
And as a result,
that's what we're asking about.
And as a result, a mistake was made during the course of that testimony that conflated two different
things. So our question, Counselor, is the person who did not give clarity, are they being held accountable? That's the question. It's not a complicated question.
The New York City Council trying to get to the bottom of reasons for erroneous information it was given by NYCHA representatives, as well as a deep dive into mismanagement by the New York City Public Housing Authority. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.
Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet. This is Baby K, host of the musical biography show The Sweet Spot, airing every third and fourth Thursday of the month at 10 p.m. Not only does WBAI bring you important news and information, it also provides some of the dopest music programming on the dial. Please support independent media and the true voice of the people by making a donation to WBAI. To make a donation, go to our website at give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org. Thank you for supporting listener-sponsored community radio. Time is really wasted.
To the current resident of the White House, the foul-mouthed orange man, we declare loud and clear, our peoples and nations are not assholes. We are proud Africans who will not be disrespected by you or anyone. This is the professor, Dr. Ron Daniels, urging everyone within the sound of my voice to attend the hashtag Proud Africans Rally, Thursday, February 15th, 11 o'clock sharp at United Nations Plaza Park, 47th Street and 1st Avenue, to repudiate Donald Trump's racism and educate the world on how Africa enriched the United States and Europe. As proud Africans, we will protest injustice, advocate policies for a better future, and organize power to protect the interests of black people. All are welcome. For further information, call 212-340-1975. That's 212-340-1975. Or follow us on Facebook at Proud Africans Empowerment. Be there.
Transmitting live from the top of the Empire State Building on 99.5 FM, WBAI New York, Pacifica Radio for the Tri-State Area. This is Trump Watch, a weekly series investigating the actions of and reactions to President Donald J. Trump and his administration. I'm your host, Jesse Lent.
Conrad, Tokyo, Sparrow, Pistachio, just unnatural. Dog is off sabbatical, rather watch an interview.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that our country don't feel like a home, and that silence speaks louder than those who condone. If a tweet to you is worth saving, then lift up your voices and put down your phones, for the times, they are a-changing. Come women and men who hashtag me too, and believe me when I say that we believe you, for weak is the man who calls truth fake news. Time's up, our silence we're breaking, and even though Mel Gibson was in daddy's home too, well the times, they are a-changing. Come athletes with platforms throughout the land, who by taking a knee are taking a stand, and before you shout out that they should be banned, listen to what they are saying. Perhaps they'd stand up if you reached out your hand. Well, the times, they are a-changing.
That was Jimmy Fallon as Bob Dylan, updating the iconic protest song as part of the Tonight Show's post-Super Bowl show on Sunday. Hello and welcome to Trump Watch. There certainly has been a whirlwind of change that I've observed covering the Donald Trump administration over the past 14 months here on the show. Tonight, we'll look back at some of our favorite moments from the first 58 episodes, as well as lift the veil a bit to let you in on how the show was created and how it gets made. When you hear the voice of the man joining me in the studio right now, for WBAI listeners, that normally means one thing. We're in pledge mode. I'm, of course, talking about none other than WBAI programming manager Tony Bates. And while it is true that the station is in the midst of our winter fun drive, and part of the episode tonight will be, of course, devoted to that most worthy cause, Tony is also the person who hired me here at the station, who co-created this show with me. Beyond the valuable feedback I get from the man who has engineered Trump Watch Live from the beginning, Mr. Reggie Johnson, Tony is the closest thing to a co-producer that I've ever had on Trump Watch. When I brought this up to him in the past, he's brushed it off as simply what a programming manager does. But his guidance has been critical in the making of this show, but we'll get to that in a minute. First, there's some critical business we need to take care of. The business of supporting WBAI. Welcome, Tony. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me and for inviting me onto the show. And I'm grateful to be here, Jesse. I'm here on Trump Watch, a show which I think does puts forward a yeoman's effort in our coverage of the White House. And what I want to talk about in terms of what we do here on Trump Watch is that we have taken our focus off of the personality in the White House and focused on the policies and the events around those policies as they affect real human beings in real time here in New York City primarily, but across the country in general. We've certainly taken time to cover the immigration issues, which affect many, many, many New Yorkers. I saw a funny sentence the other day, which read, I'm paraphrasing, something to the effect that 80% of New Yorkers are minorities. There's one of them oxymorons. How can 80% be a minority? But those issues that are pouring out of the White House affect New Yorkers differently now. And WBAI has to adjust the way that we look at these issues. One of the struggles on the left has been that because of the history of this country, we see topics in black and white. Brown is often left out of that equation. We have to include that, and that's what we've begun to do here with that understanding, with input from our brown brothers and sisters here on the producing staff and throughout the WBAI family. We make room for all, or not all, but as many of the WBAI listening family as we can, and we try to be as broad as we can, and that's what we do on Trump Watch. Our goal is not to give shrift to the orange knucklehead in the White House, but to really unpack the issues surrounding his policies, the people he's put into place. And as we have critiqued some of those people, we've seen them go down and leave. If we, on this very program, said, I'll bet you this won't go well, and then it didn't. And so I'm really happy about what's happening on Trump Watch, what we've been able to accomplish with the program. And today our focus is, folks, having you support this program. We don't normally fundraise directly on Trump Watch. We bring you incredible interviews. Jesse, you might list some of the folks you've had on the air over the, I didn't even realize it had been over a year. You said 14 months.
Yes.
I don't know what day of the week it is because it's Fun Drive, so, you know.
It's Wednesday, and we've been doing it every Wednesday since early December. You know, the first Trump Watch now, there's one in L.A., there's one on Thursday, but this little show on Wednesday.
Oh, they did bite us in L.A., didn't they?
Well,
they bit our idea in L.A. and created their own show called Trump Watch. Some of them might even have tried to take credit for it, just saying. We'd be kicking behind over here at WBAI, and the rest of the network has to follow us.
Well, I have nothing to say about that except that I say the more the merrier. There's certainly no shortage of material to work with, but one thing that, to the best of my knowledge, none of the other Trump Watches are doing is something that you and I, and I don't know how deep we want to go on this just at the top of the show, but you know, when you and I were talking about this show in the very early stages, in the pre-production stages, that was where I think we both had the need and the desire to do something different on what was the most talked about subject in the world at the time, and arguably still today. And that was where we eventually drifted into this one topic, one interview, one question format that I think has really served the show well. Of, you know, and as you said, yes, there's been a lot. We've been really lucky to get a lot of incredible guests. You know, I've spoken to David K. Johnston, the Pulitzer Prize winning writer, The Making of Donald Trump, who just put out a new book this week. It's Worse Than You Think. I've gotten to speak with America's foremost Donald Trump impersonator, the great Alec Baldwin. We actually possibly might listen to some of that interview tonight, as well as you know, the Iran bureau chief for Reuters, Parisa Hafezi in Iran, the Kabul bureau chief for the New York Times. You know, the tremendous thing about this show is getting to see a subject that I personally am slightly confused about and seek out the people that I think are covering it the best to try to get those answers for me and hopefully by extension for the listening audience.
And what happens also on this program, Jesse, is that you make it palatable and consumable for an average audience. And that's important because often the ideas that we have to break down in WBAI can be esoteric, as it were. Some of the ideas that we focus on here on a regular basis are kind of out of reach to folks. And on this program, we kind of take a more pragmatic look at what's happening in the daily news cycle as relates to the White House and as relates to the people in the White House and the policies coming out of it. And I think that it's been incredibly enlightening for WBAI listeners and certainly folks around New York, whether they call in here and let us know they're listening or not. So it's what we wanted to do. It's the fact is, in the beginning stages of the program, I thought it needed to be changed. But ultimately, I realized that you were adding an element to WBAI that needed to be added. And I don't want to say what that element is, but the show works on a level that is expansive in that it reaches across audiences and it's broad. Anyone can listen to it. It's inclusive. And that's what our goal is to do here at WBAI now. In some cases, we've been narrow. We've narrow cast with our broadcast signal. And my idea, my vision is to broaden what we do in general to bring more New Yorkers, more New Jerseyers, more Pennsylvanianers, whomever can reach, whomever this signal can reach. We want them listening to WBI. And why? Because we think it's important, folks. We understand that we're doing something that isn't happening anywhere else in the media. And what we're distilling on this program and on this station impact people because they get to see the story differently. What you hear on the mainstream, either side is sound bites and short clips. We get to do long form, deep looks at policy and also at people within the administration. And I feel like it served the WBA audience well.
Yeah, that's actually an idea that came directly from you. I remember in the early days of the show, the sort of personality-driven episodes, I would call them, you know, the Steve Bannon episode. We were actually lucky to do a really deep dive on John Kelly when he was the head of the Homeland Security. Jonah Walter from Jacobin came in and talked about his history with SOCOM in South America. And then just, I think, less than 2 weeks later, he happened to take over as Trump's chief of staff. So that sort of thing has happened a lot. And, you know,
but even the angle that that interview took went completely different than where I expected it to go.
Yeah, as well as for me, once you get into some of the history, you know, I mean, I wanted to respond to just something you said really quickly, which is the idea of this being broad and maybe not as in the weeds, not as sort of, I do my best on the show not to make any assumptions about anyone listening.
I wish people would do that with me.
The idea is, you know, really trying to keep that that concept close of if you can't explain something well, you don't truly understand it. And my girlfriend is a non-English speaker, and I always ask her how
well,
much...
Well, not a non-English speaker, but English isn't her first language.
Thank you very much for that clarification. I'm going to get major heat for that.
You certainly are.
But as a non-native English speaker, the idea of trying to break things down and make it clear is always something, and I do my best to really ask anyone who's listening to the show, did it make more sense to you? Because again, you know, if you haven't heard many episodes of the show, maybe you haven't noticed, but my big priority is not to spike the basketball. This shows how athletic I am. Not to spike the football, not to sort of run up the score, or I have no real interest in being a kind of partisan talk radio personality in either direction. I really am looking for some kind of understanding. You know, it's funny. I actually, maybe this would be a good time to bring it out. You know, I actually found the original pitch, the rough draft of the show of Trump Watch that got into this, you know, when we first, when you agreed to at least have me on the air as a trial basis. One of the first things that you said, one of the first things you tasked me with was, you know, write a proposal for the show, figure out what it should be. And
that is because, Jesse, I believe that whatever folks write, however they describe their programs in the beginning, is kind of like a guide, a map to where to go. When you think the program's become too long or you've been doing it too long, you don't know what to say next, go back to that original statement. Why did you begin to do this? What did you want to convey to the audience? And when people read that again, I have people go back to that on a regular basis. I insist that people write this. And it is because when you are lost, you can find your way back by reading what your idea was from the very beginning. And when you begin to give that to the audience again, you're coming from a place of giving and providing information rather than a place of ego often. And this is what I have to say.
Well, Tony and Reggie will back me up that this is not a bit. This is actually a rough draft handwritten that I found.
I will not back you up on that.
Come on, have my back. and I'm just going to read this really quickly because it kind of it was amusing to me. I think we've gone and accomplished, at least we're on the way to accomplishing this. The best radio moments occur when there is no agenda being used, when ideas are being shared by a guest or a caller, when you are hearing the voices of the city push and pull each other, and even occasionally reach accordance. With the right focus, such a program could attract both the political neophyte and the jaded pundit for the same reason. We would be exploring issues or angles that haven't been tackled before. And this is one part that kind of cracked me up. Some potential topics would be exploring Trump's plan to ban Muslims, which was only a plan at that point. Did Putin want Trump to win the election? I think we know the answer to that question at this point. And finally, are the Democrats destined to be doomed by hand-wringing over identity politics? I should mention that was all written in late November, early December of 2016.
Yes, it was. And now, folks, we're going to take a moment to pause here and ask you to do what we do during Fund Drive, and that's to support this program. We are not offering you a premium today. We want you to pledge because you believe in this program. So the first thing that I want to encourage you to do is to visit WBAI.org. There you will see near the top of the page a thermometer, which has several levels at which you can pledge. We want to hear from you. We need you to pledge now. Go to WBAI.org, look at that thermometer, click on the $25, click on the $50, click on the $100 level, make a pledge of support to WBAI. The form will, of course, allow you to use your American Express card, your Discover card, your Visa card, or MasterCard, but make a pledge of support to Trump Watch and WBAI. Here's the thing, folks. I get lots of complaints about the programming that people don't want to hear. I put things on the air, so I am broad. I am way out there and way in here in terms of the political spectrum, in terms of the other spectrums that we go into on WBAI. But I understand our need to reach out to and touch our audience. And I think that this program does that. And so what we're asking, folks, is that if you believe in the show, if you tune into this show and you're edified on a weekly basis, or every time you turn into the show, you appreciate the work put into the show. And believe me, if you're listening to the program, you can hear the quality. If you have listened to radio for any amount of time, when you tune into Trump Watch, you can hear how much effort is being put into the program. We're asking you to support that. Those of you who haven't gone to WBAI.org already and made a pledge, and do that. It only takes about 3 minutes. Again, WBAI.org. Just go there. You'll see the thermometer. You can click on $10. You can click on $25. You can click on $50, $100. There are those of you out there who can pledge at the $1,000 level because you believe in the program, because you appreciate the program, and you know the kind of work that Jesse puts into this program every week. Pick up the phone now if you are not on a website and call us at 516-620-3602. Our goal for this half hour is 5 WBAI buddies. What's a WBAI buddy? Well, that's a person who becomes a sustaining member of WBAI. What that means is you give us a credit card number or maybe a banking routing number, and we, on a monthly basis, take money out of your account. You will barely know it's gone. And it sustains a program. You become a subscribing member of the program. You can pledge at the $10 level. That'll be $120 over the next 12 months. You could pledge at the $25 level per month. You know, Jesse, I once got a pledge at KPFK for $13,000. The person called up and pledged $1,000 a month for 13 months. Just 1 month less than this program has been on the air. And there are folks in our listening audience right now who can pledge that $1,000 pledge or that $500 pledge. We're asking you to do that, folks. Step up now. 516-620-3602. We want five of you to agree to become sustaining members for Trump Watch. Agree to support the kind of programming that you can tune into for consistency, the kind of programming that you can tune into for quality, the kind of programming that you can tune into for fair and unbiased reporting. Not that we like that orange dude in the White House, but as you heard Jesse say in the beginning of the program, he tries to tackle issues in a way they appeal broadly and that they are unbiased, specifically because it is the message that is important more than the personality, either the personality the story is focused on or the personality on the other side of the microphone. This is about you. This is about getting you the information you believe WBAI should be bringing you. It's also about WBAI, the greatest radio station in New York City. Pick up your phone, please. 516-620-3602. While you are dialing, we're going to play a short clip from Alec Baldwin, who was on the show a few months ago. What was it, around December, I guess?
Back in November.
In November. Yeah. Alec Baldwin agreed to come on the show. We were talking, Jesse was saying, I don't know if I can get Alec Baldwin. I said, reach out. Let's just give it a shot. He knows who we are. He's been on WBAI before. And surely enough, Alec Baldwin agreed to come on WBAI and talk about Trump because he had a new book coming out along with Neil, who was a co-author.
Right. This is the host of Studio 360, Kurt Anderson. Who actually, there's another episode on SoundCloud.com, TrumpWatch/TrumpWatchWBAI, our podcast.
Wait, can you say that again in a speed that we can all
write
it down?
Right, in a human hearing speed. This is SoundCloud.com/TrumpWatchWBAI, our podcast, or you can just type Trump Watch with Jesse Lent wherever you get your podcasts. We also have the Kurt Anderson, the full interview with his co-author, Kurt Anderson, of the book You Can't Spell America Without Me, the really tremendous true story of my first year as president, a Trump parody book the two of them wrote together. But this is me asking Alec about how the Trump impression came to be and what's in his mind while he's doing it.
Before we get to that clip, 516-620-3602, we need to hear from you. Make a pledge at the $25 level, $50 level, do what you can, or become a WBAI buddy and put down Trump Watch as the program that you're going to support. 516-620-3602.
Let's go back to when you were first tasked to play Donald Trump on Saturday Night Live by creator and producer Lorne Michaels. As you've described numerous times, Tina Fey urged him to cast you. Why do you think Tina felt so strongly that you should play Trump?
I have no idea. Maybe she felt that there was parts of my personality that were like Trump. I mean, you never know with Tina. You're always going to get that mean girl's treatment. You know what I mean? Maybe she was trying to give me a subtle dig. You never know. But I did hear that. I never heard that from Tina that I can remember, but I do remember Lorne calling me and saying that he and Tina had cooked up this idea. But listen, Daryl Hammond was on the show for years and was a very wonderful Trump impersonator. And the only thing I can think of is that Daryl is so kind and so sweet, and his Trump impersonation was so kind of velvety. And that's before Trump became president. I think once Trump became president, we had to kind of amp up the danger of Trump and the threat that Trump poses. So once Trump was running for office, and although we were all convinced he wouldn't win, once he won, this kind of guest gig I had for a couple of episodes turned into this semi-full-time thing, because I think what I try to bring out is the malice in Trump and the discontent of Trump and the bitterness. You know, when I play Trump, I try to make him the bitterest man in the world.
What's on your mind while you're playing him? Do you try to keep a clear mind, or are you thinking of something?
What's on my mind when I'm playing him? And what am I thinking? I'm thinking that I hope people appreciate this. I hope they find it funny. And there's absolutely no method acting thing where I try to, you know, become Trump. What I'm doing is a caricature. It's a silly, dopey caricature of this guy. Because we are doing a 5-minute burst of comedy at the beginning of a live television show. We don't have the opportunity. We don't have the wherewithal to have a more finely honed Trump impersonation. We got to kind of drive this thing and keep it moving because it's a live TV show. So we do the best we can.
You know, and I have to say, that was for people just tuning in, my interview from back in November with Alec Baldwin, America's foremost Trump impersonator. And you're listening to Trump Watch on WBAI, and I'm here with Tony Bates. You know, my name is Jesse Lent. As a Saturday Night Live nerd, that was just a thrill to be able to go behind the scenes a little bit. And, you know, it's one of those things where every interview with Alec you hear, Tina Fey said this, Tina Fey, but no one asked him, well, did you hear about this? You know, mm-hmm. why did Tina Fey think? And he said something very interesting. Well, with Tina Fey, you always get that Mean Girls treatment. So he almost thinks that maybe it was a little bit of a thumb in the nose, you know, like asking him to do that. So
I used to be a stand-up comic, and no stand-up comic wants any other stand-up comic to succeed. That's not exactly true, but yeah, there's a lot of, it's shocking how angry comics might be. But you know what? What happened here is we reached out to one of America's sweethearts, Alec Baldwin, and he said yes to WBAI. You know why? He's been on WBAI before. He understands who we are, and he appreciates the message that we put forward, as we expect of you folks. 516-620-3602. Become a WBAI buddy. You can also do that at givetowbai.org. And what that means is you put this on a credit card or check, you become a standing member. We take $10 out of your bank account. $120 later, you've supported the station for a year. You don't even miss it. You spend $10 a day at a cup of coffee. Or many of us pick up our cable bill and you send money to Fox and you send money to CNN and MSNBC and NBC. You're paying them to lie to you. Send us the money and we'll tell you the truth with it. That's what we do here. We're going to take that $10 a month and we're going to stretch it into 50,000 watts of power, 50,000 watts of truth, 50,000 watts of WBAI, 50,000 watts of people-powered radio. That's what we do here at WBAI. That's what we do here on Trump Watch. And that's why we are asking you to pick up your phone and pledge at 516-620-3602. This is your station. This is your program. We can't do this unless you do that. And what is that? Well, you pick up that phone and you dial 516-620-3602. You pledge that support and you make sure that WBAI and Trump Watch are here next Wednesday and the Wednesday following that. And the Wednesday and Thursday, Trump Watch comes on Wednesday and Thursday, a different host, our own Paul DiRienzo on Thursdays. But make sure that it's here. Make sure that the programming that you can tune into consistently and believe in is here. You do that by pledging your support. 516-620-3602. And if you are that party who can pledge at the $1,000 level to say thank you to Jesse Lent for putting in the work here, to say thank you to WBAI for having a program named Trump Watch, which beautifully takes a look in only a half an hour, folks. The show is only given a half an hour. It really should be a longer show. But we do.
I agree.
I shouldn't have said that out loud in front of the staff. But we do it. We manage it in half an hour, and that is something to support. 516-620-3602.
And thank you so much for your support. Please be sure, if you do donate, to mention in the form that it's for Trump Watch with Jesse Lent, and send a message to management here at WBAI, to the Pacifica Network, that this is the kind of programming that you want to hear on your radio station, WBAI.
Jesse, I think Pacifica got the message already. They already started another Trump Watch.
We know they're listening. We know we have their attention. And, you know, I just want to say that it's been a pleasure and an honor working with Tony Bates. I think a lot of people see the management style and side of this guy. They don't see his production style, which has been just tremendously tremendously helpful for me. So thank you, Tony.
You're welcome, Jesse. And I also want to shout out John Wiener, our colleague at KPFK, who's doing something. The man is brilliant. Nothing but good words for him. I'll tell you that right now. And he does a similar show. But what we do here at WBAI is we start the trend and then it moves left to the West Coast. That's how we get down at WBAI, folks. And that's because of you and your support. We've been doing this for 57 years because you've been doing this for 57 years. Please call in and pledge your support. 516-620-3602. We've got a minute left. We need to get you on the phone to become a WBAI buddy in support of Trump Watch with Jesse Lent. 516-620-3602. We've got to get out of here. We want to say thank you for your pledges of support.
And that's going to do it for this week. You can hear all 58 episodes of Trump Watch with Jesse Lent at soundcloud.com/TrumpWatchWBAI or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter where our handle is TrumpWatchWBAI. I'll be back next Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. when we'll break down another aspect of the Donald Trump administration. Until then, I'm your host, Jesse Lent. Talk to you next time.
And once again, this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Yes, we are still in fundraising mode. Actually, not still, because we just started this week. We're in day number 3 of our winter fundraiser here, raising funds to make sure that this institution known as WBAI continues to provide you information that you expect from us here on a regular basis. Programs like Trump Watch, both Wednesday and Thursday, as well as the WBAI Evening News, as well as Democracy Now!, as well as Economic Update, and other shows like that. But we can only do that with the help of listeners like yourself. So, if you haven't done so already, please consider becoming a financial supporter to this radio station right now by calling 516-620-3602. Once again, 516-620-3602, or go to give to WBAI.org on the web. That's give to, the number 2, give to WBAI.org on the web. And also you can text to donate. Text WBAI to 41444 on your smartphone. Text WBAI to 41444 on your smartphone. You'll send that. You'll receive a link. You open up that link on your smartphone and a page will appear and it will ask you how much you want to donate to WBAI. You can donate as little as $5, but don't stop there. If you have more money to spare to donate to this radio station, we'll take it definitely, because this is nonprofit and we're solely sponsored by listeners like yourselves. So $5, $25, $50, $100, $200, $500, you get the idea. Whatever amount you feel comfortable in donating, please, by all means, do so, and it will be a tax deduction on your part as well. A win-win situation, I must say. Stay tuned for more fundraising programming coming up. It is now 2 minutes past 7 p.m. here on WBAI New York and WBAI.org on the web. Once again, 516-620-3602, or go to give to WBAI.org on the web.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. As the debate rages on about what the U.S. military is now doing on the continent of Africa following the killing of four U.S. troops in Niger. The context, in part, is the historic role the United States and European nations played in not only creating artificial borders in Africa, but also extracting huge wealth from the continent, a practice that continues today in what is being called a form of neo-colonialism. Africa's population is over 1 billion, living in 55 different countries, speaking over 2,000 languages. The population in Africa is also the youngest in the world, leading many to admit that what happens in and to Africa will play a major role in geopolitics and world economies. So it is important to know the history and situation in Africa for those of us living in the United States. Africa's importance to the future of us all is compounded, underscored by Africa being the richest continent in the world due to cobalt, uranium, oil, diamonds, and more found under the ground. Yet its people remain the most impoverished in the world. The resistance of African people to colonialism began with the slave trade by Arab nations in the north, and to Europe and the United States, who took that slave trade in the Americas to new heights. But the movement for independence of African nations grew in earnest during the last century. That was a time of great hope for Africa, a time when the possibility of African unity seemed possible, an enthusiasm that spread in the African diaspora in the Americas to the politics of Pan-Africanism. African leaders like Kwame Nkrumah, Julius Nyerere, Patrice Lumumba led the struggle for African unity. But the United States and former colonial powers, with their eyes on Africa's wealth, and the U.S. worried about the impact of successful, true African independence, the impact that would have on the black population in the United States and across the Americas. So they set about undermining and redirecting, trying to control those independence movements and continue to prop up the apartheid state in South Africa. Their assassination of the young first prime minister of a newly independent Congo, Patrice Lumumba, was a key blow to Africa. Here is a clip from the classic film Lumumba.
What was it about the man, Patrice Lumumba, that made them so afraid? Was it that he dared to dream out loud of freedom and brotherhood for his fellow Congolese? The year was 1960 and the Belgian Congo was becoming an independent Congo. It was a new country full of enthusiasm, fury, and violence. Who could be trusted with such powerful enemies working behind the scenes? Who could foresee the events that would destroy the hopes of this new nation? Lumumba, a film by Raoul Peck.
But former colonial powers ran into resistance not only from indigenous African freedom fighters, but in stepped Cuba, fresh from its successful revolution in 1959 and ready to offer practical help and troops to independence fighters in Africa. Today, Cuba's role in winning independence of several African nations, including the freeing of Nelson Mandela from his South Africa prison. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. The deadline for another stopgap spending bill runs out tomorrow night. Lawmakers say they are on track to avoid a repeat of last month's government shutdown, though President Donald Trump unexpectedly raised that possibility if he doesn't get his way on immigration.
If we don't change the legislation, if we don't get rid of these loopholes where killers are allowed to come into our country and continue to kill gang members, and we're just talking about MS-13, there are many gang members that we don't even mention. If we don't change it, let's have a shutdown. We'll do a shutdown, and it's worth it for our country. I'd love to see a shutdown if we don't get this stuff taken care of.
Trump's comments were disconnected from progress on Capitol Hill, where the House passed a short-term spending measure last night on a largely party-line vote of 245 to 182. Senate leaders were closing in on a larger long-term pact. The broader agreement would award large spending increases to both the Pentagon and domestic federal programs, as well as approve overdue disaster relief aid. Democratic leaders have dropped the strategy of using the funding fight to extract concessions on immigration, specifically on seeking extended protections for the young undocumented immigrants known as Dreamers brought to this country as children. White House Chief of Staff John Kelly threw fuel on the dispute as he defended Trump's proposed solution. The retired general noted the White House proposal would expand protection to include 1.8 million people, far more than the 690,000 who currently have DACA protections. He said Trump's proposal would include some people who were, quote, too lazy to sign up previously.
There are 690,000 official DACA registrants. And the president sent over what amounts to be 2.5 times that number to 1.8 million. The difference between 690 and 1.8 million were the people that some would say were too afraid to sign up, others would say were too lazy to get off their asses, but they didn't sign up.
Democrats challenged Kelly for his slur. Senate Democratic Leader Dick Durbin of Illinois, the party's chief immigration negotiator, added, quote, "It doesn't surprise me from General Kelly." Kelly is known as a hardliner on immigration. The White House says Donald Trump was just joking when he said Democrats may have been guilty of treason for not applauding during his State of the Union address. White House spokesman Hogan Gidley said the remark was tongue-in-cheek, but added that, quote, "What's serious is it seems as though the Democrats put their personal hatred for this president over their desires to see this country succeed." Arizona Republican Jeff Flake took to the Senate floor to say accusations of treason are not a joking matter.
I have seen the president's most ardent defenders use the now weary argument that the president's comments were meant as a joke, just sarcasm, only tongue in cheek. But treason is not a punchline, Mr. President. We must recognize that this is aberrant, destructive behavior, whatever rationale its defenders may offer.
In a tweet, Illinois Democratic Senator Tammy Duckworth, a double amputee veteran of the Iraq War, worked in a reminder that Trump had deferments during the Vietnam War for bone spurs. Duckworth wrote, quote, "We don't live in a dictatorship or a monarchy. I swore an oath in the military and in the Senate to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, not to mindlessly cater to the whims of cadet bone spurs and clap when he demands I clap," Duckworth tweeted. Donald Trump has asked the Pentagon to plan a grand parade of the armed forces in Washington this year to celebrate U.S. military strength. The Washington Post first reported Trump's January request. It quoted an unidentified military official as saying, "The marching orders were, I want a parade like the one in France." Trump was on hand for France's Bastille Day military parade when he visited Paris last July. New airstrikes launched by Russian and Syrian government forces on a besieged rebel-held region east of Damascus killed at least 8 people, according to opposition activists. The airstrikes on eastern Ghouta have killed dozens of civilians in the past few days. The punishing campaign by Russia and Syria also has battered the northwestern province of Idlib, the largest area under opposition control in Syria. The Idlib offensive hit hospitals and residential buildings. A hospital official in Idlib stood among the ruins of the facility. His remarks were broadcast on Al Jazeera.
The third airstrike was the most intense. It destroyed the entire hospital. I'm sorry to say that we've lost a huge medical institution serving the entire area. I have no alternative. Everyone is asking me where to go. I have no answer.
The children's organization Save the Children said in a statement the escalation in fighting in Idlib is placing thousands of children in extreme danger. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
If we really want to unravel what U.S. military troops are doing on the continent of Africa, including